Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the program. I'm Tracy McClure with you over the next half hour. Coming up today, we'll be looking at the Sunday Gospel reading for the week, and a tip for summertime pilgrims ahead of the Marian Feast of the Assumption. We go to the Rome Basilica of St. Mary Major. That's where Pope Francis often goes to pray to Our Lady. We take a peek at some of the church treasures there on exhibit. We begin today's program with There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye, a program written by Jill Bevilacqua.
Jesus said to his disciples, "Let your belts be fastened around your waists, and your lamps be burning ready. Be like men awaiting their master's return from a wedding, so that when he arrives and knocks, you will open for him without delay. It will go well with those servants whom the master finds wide awake on his return. I tell you, he will put on an apron, seat them at table, and proceed to wait on them. Should he happen to come at midnight or before sunrise and find them prepared, it will go well with them. You know as well as I that if the head of the house knew when the thief was coming, he would not let him break into his house. Be on guard, therefore. The Son of Man will come when you least expect him."
Although the language of today's translations is generally adapted to our modern ears, there's very little real difference in the wording of today's parable, for the meaning is so clear. The Jerusalem Bible version doesn't even refer to items of clothing, such as belts, but reads simply, "See that you are dressed for action." The earlier versions, such as the Vulgate, and even the Revised Standard Version, use the phrase which is described today as poetic or literary, "Let your loins be girded," or girt. And today's dictionary defines gird as "to encircle or secure with a belt or band," often in the phrase "to gird one's loins," meaning to prepare and strengthen oneself for what is to come. And a definition of 1450 reads simply "to prepare oneself for action." A Bible scholar suggests that Jesus was recalling the night of the Passover, when the Israelites were ready for the long march towards the Promised Land, with their garments belted. They had been told how they were to eat that supper.
"You shall eat like this, with your loins girded, sandals on your feet, a staff in your hand."
Another writer comments, the biblical expression "to gird up the loins" meant to put on the girdle. It signified that the person was ready for service. On the other hand, to loose the girdle meant that the person was either lazy or resting.
"None of them faint or weary, none sleeping or drowsy, none of them with belt loose, none with sandal straps broken."
Thus Isaiah. Peter, in his first letter, uses the phrase "having the loins of your mind girt up," which takes the idea of readiness even further. And Peter himself is shown on two occasions as unprepared or taken by surprise. In the last chapter of John, when Jesus appears by the lakeside and calls to the apostles, and John to Peter whispers, "It is the Lord."
Simon Peter, when he heard that it was the Lord, girt his coat about him, for he was naked, and cast himself into the sea.
And a writer of biblical times tells us,
"Ordinarily, Jewish men wore an inner garment, an outer garment, a girdle, and sandals. The inner garment resembled a close-fitting shirt. The most common Hebrew word for this garment is translated variously as coat, robe, tunic, and garment. A man wearing only this inner garment was said to be naked."
Another famous occasion when Peter was caught unawares is recounted in the Acts of the Apostles. Herod had arrested Peter, and on the night before he was to be tried, this is what happened.
Peter was sleeping between two soldiers, fastened with double chains, while guards kept watch at the main entrance to the prison. Then suddenly, the angel of the Lord stood there, and the cell was filled with light. He tapped Peter on the side and woke him. "Get up," he said. "Hurry." And the chains fell from his hands. The angel then said, "Put on your belt and sandals." After he'd done this, the angel next said, "Wrap your cloak around you and follow me."
No blame can be attached to Peter, of course, for either of these occasions when he was found to be unready. Not a word we use, really, but it reminds me of an old nickname given to an English king, Ethelred II, who came to the throne in the year 978, must, write the historians, have been weak and indecisive. His nickname, the Unready, is a modern version or corruption of unrede or redeless, meaning poor counsel or evil counsel or unwise, whereas the name Ethelred meant noble counsel. Poor Ethelred, rather than unready, he seems to have been unlucky. In the second part of the opening to our Gospel, Jesus tells his disciples to have their lamps burning ready. This immediately calls to mind the other parable where lamps feature strongly, the parable of the wise and foolish virgins. Where today we have servants waiting for their master to return from a wedding, in the other parable the virgins are awaiting for the bridegroom. But in each case it's essential that the lamps be burning. For us who switch on a light effortlessly, the power of the image is greatly diminished. We have no need to remember to keep a supply of oil to fill the lamps when they burn low. But only a few centuries ago, the readers of John Milton's poem Comus wouldn't have found these lines so very strange.
O thievish night, why shouldst thou, but for some felonious end, in thy dark lantern thus close up the stars that nature hung in heaven, and filled their lamps with everlasting oil to give due light to the misled and lonely traveller?
Not only the stars, but the sun and the moon have both been called lamps by the poets. Robert Herrick, in his most celebrated lyric, To Virgins to Make Much of Time, wrote, "The glorious lamp of heaven, the sun, the higher he's a-getting, the sooner will his race be run, and nearer he's to setting." And I well remember my mother playing the old ballad in those days when we all used to gather round the piano to sing, "The moon has raised her lamp above." But music and poetry aside, what is a lamp? Any of various devices for producing visible light, runs today's definition. But a 1933 dictionary has this description.
A vessel containing oil which is burnt at a wick for the purpose of illumination. Now also a vessel of glass or the like, enclosing a candle, oil, a gas jet, or an incandescent wire.
When those words were written, the incandescent wire of our common light bulb had been around for some 50 years. But not every household had electricity, confined indeed at first to the streets of cities. Until then, it had been up to the lamplighter to distribute starlight, as Robert Louis Stevenson put it.
The lamplighters took to their heels every evening and ran with a good heart. And though now and then an individual may have been knocked on the head by the ladder of the flying functionary, yet people taught their children to say, "God bless the lamplighter."
And to this popular character, Stevenson dedicated a children's poem.
My tea is nearly ready and the sun has left the sky. It's time to take the window to see Leary going by. For every night at tea time and before you take your seat, with lantern and with ladder he comes posting up the street.
And like all small boys, he dreams of doing the same when he grows up.
Oh, Leary, I'll go round at night and light the lamps with you.
But this was not to be. In A Plea for Gas Lamps, Stevenson writes of the man reflecting on progress. Out of the age of gas lamps, he glances back slightingly at the murk and glimmer in which his ancestors wandered. The era of oil lights, hard to kindle, easy to extinguish, pale and wavering in the hour of their endurance. When Stevenson wrote his essay, an experiment in street lighting by electricity had only just been made in Pall Mall, London, so he reflected, remembering Leary and mourning his passing.
For not much longer shall we watch him speeding up the street, and at measured intervals knocking another luminous hole into the dusk. Our tame stars are to come out in future, not one by one, but all in a body and at once. It is proposed that we should henceforth take our walks abroad in the glare of permanent lighting.
And such is this lightning glare in our cities today that astronomers must go to the desert to observe the stars. When the Israelites were journeying in the desert, their light was the pillar of fire, and to this day the Jews recall that time in the Feast of Tabernacles. In our Lord's day, on the first evening of the festival, golden lampstands were set up in the court of the women in the temple. Great candelabra, some 150 feet high, which the priests then lit as soon as darkness fell, while the crowd sang canticles, lighting innumerable other lights of every kind. It was, we're told, an occasion of riotous illumination. Perhaps Jesus himself had this feast in mind when, in the Sermon on the Mount, he used the images of a lamp to tell his disciples they were the light of the world.
No one lights a lamp to put it under a tub. They put it on the lampstand where it shines for everyone in the house. In the same way, your light must shine.
The lamps we must hold ready are for a different purpose, to welcome the return of the Master, and perhaps to help us stay awake. And there's that line from the psalm to remind us of what will keep us from stumbling.
Now your word is a lamp to my feet, a light on my path.
In the 16th century, it was not uncommon for a king or queen to announce at short notice that he or she would be your guest for the night. It paid to be always ready for such an announcement. An anonymous poet of the time describes what would most likely ensue, and adds a sober reflection. Let's close then with preparations.
Yet if His Majesty, our Sovereign Lord, should of His own accord friendly Himself invite, and say, I'll be your guest tomorrow night, how should we stir ourselves? Call and command all hands to work, let no man idle stand. Set me fine Spanish tables in the hall, see they be fitted all. Let there be room to eat, and order taken, that there want no meat. See every sconce and candlestick made bright, that without tapers they may give a light. Look to the presents, are the carpets spread, the daisy o'er the head, the cushions in the chairs, and all the candles lighted on the stairs. Perfume the chambers, and in any case let each man give attendance in his place. Thus, if a king were coming, would we do? And 'twere good reason too, for 'tis a duteous thing to show all honour to an earthly king, and after all our travail and our cost, so he be pleased to think no labour lost. But at the coming of the King of Heaven, all set at 6 and 7, we wallow in our sin. Christ cannot find a chamber in the inn. We entertain him always like a stranger, and as at first, still lodge him in the manger.
And thanks there to Jill Bevilacqua for that program with readings by Sean Patrick Lovett. Have you ever wondered what happens to some of the finely crafted reliquaries, monstrances, and other objects used by popes and even saints in liturgical rites? It's not hard to imagine how many might be stuffed away in sacristy cupboards or displayed in areas where the public can't always see them. Well, the Basilica of St. Mary Major here in Rome has dusted off its collection of historic liturgical and artistic treasures for visitors to peruse at their leisure down in its crypt. Pope John Paul II himself inaugurated the museum on December 8, 2001. Here, besides the vestments and chalices of past popes, you'll even find relics from the life of Jesus and something once held dear to the 17th century sculptor Gian Lorenzo Bernini, the designer of St. Peter's Square. Come with me on this, the first of a two-part tour of the museum. My guide, Professor Arnold Nesselrath, the Vatican Museum's curator with whose help the museum was first created. We started our tour looking back on that December day when Pope John Paul blessed the new museum beneath the Basilica of St. Mary Major. Professor Nesselrath, you were a consultant in this project of creating the museum. On the 8th of December, you were there when Pope John Paul came. You said the basilica was empty, and it gave there was a real special feeling there when he was here.
The 8th of December, the Feast of the Immaculate Conception, is the traditional day of the year when the Pope visits the Basilica of Santa Maria Maggiore. So he goes to the Spanish Square and prays in front of the column, and then he comes.
The column with the statue of the Virgin Mary atop.
The statue of the Virgin Mary on top. And then he comes to Santa Maria Maggiore. So he drove into the courtyard, and the first thing he did when he got off his car, he blessed the museum from the entrance.
In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Spirit of Son.
Amen.
And then he walked into the basilica, which was empty, which was lit with a splendid light. And in a very almost personal ceremony, he walked through the basilica. He visited the new holy door, which is only open during the holy year, which was newly installed. It was a very quiet, very moving ceremony.
St. Mary Major is one of the four patriarchal basilicas in Rome. The first church on the site was founded about the year 350 by Pope Liberius. According to tradition, the basilica was founded after the Virgin Mary appeared to a patrician man, revealing to him her desire that a church be built in her honour on Mount Esquilino. Pope Liberius is said to have received the same message in a dream. A miraculous snowfall on a hot summer day revealed the location which Mary had chosen for her basilica, also known as Our Lady of the Snow. Today, the legend is commemorated each year on August the 5th, when white rose petals are dropped from the dome during the liturgy. The original church was restored or possibly rebuilt by Pope Sixtus III in the year 432. In 1348, it was damaged by an earthquake and restored some years later. The basilica underwent a series of important additions and embellishments throughout subsequent years.
Now, why is a museum like this so important in the church for the faithful?
I think small museums in general are important because there are not only great works of art, but there are also other works of art that people should appreciate. And you have to get with these objects to many people. Now, in this particular case, it gives access to the treasures of the basilica. It really is the treasure of the church that is exhibited here. And it has an extraordinary success. So a lot of people come here. The comments are extremely positive.
The museum's guest book is filling up very quickly. Here's what one pair of British pilgrims wrote.
We were so interested to see the shirt of St. Thomas of Canterbury, as we're from Canterbury and saw it when this church lent it for the exhibition in Canterbury Cathedral. Signed Philly and Susan Cheatham on the 15th of March 2002.
people seem to be taking something away, an experience that they've made in this museum, whether they're of Christian faith or whether they're not of Christian faith, they take a positive reaction back, and I think that's important, and it's something one really should build on.
Now let's talk about how the museum is laid out. It is beneath the basilica, where the crypts used to be.
Well, the stratigraphy of the basilica is very complex. It's built like all of Rome, but in particular the big Christian buildings, on Roman foundations. So it grew until the basilica was laid out by Sixtus III in the 5th century. And so the first section of the museum tries to give an idea of this building so people know where they are, know about how this place, how this site developed. There are pieces from the excavations underneath the basilica, an early Christian mensa from an early Christian altar. There are engravings, there are very beautiful miniatures showing the basilica, what it looked like in the 18th century. There is a reference to the King of Spain, who has a special relationship to this basilica. Every King of Spain is always a member of the chapter of the basilica. And then we're trying to inform the people of what the main relics are that are preserved here. The one is the famous portrait of the Madonna, according to the ancient legend, painted by St. Luke himself, then a relic of the Holy Cross, and then the wood from the manger in Bethlehem, which was brought here. They reconstructed a grotto, and then over the centuries built various reliquaries for it. So these are the main three sections in the first big hall. And then we are dealing with the many reliquaries that papal basilica site like Santa Maria Maggiore has, with wonderful objects designed by various goldsmiths over the centuries, amongst them the shirt of St. Thomas Becket.
St. Thomas Becket of Canterbury was born about the year 1118. He studied law and became Archdeacon of Canterbury in 1154. 1 year later, King Henry II made him Chancellor. In the position of Archbishop of Canterbury some years later, Becket openly opposed the king on a number of issues, including church loyalty to the Pope in Rome, eventually leading to his assassination in 1170.
This basilica always has an archpriest. We have a section on the archpriest. We have a section on the chapter with such important vestments as those of San Carlo Borromeo, but also up to the present day. Then we have monstrances, gifts to the basilica.
A monstrance is a vessel used for exposing the Eucharistic host for veneration. It often consists of a frame of golden or silver rays, in the centre of which is a receptacle with a glass window through which the host may be seen.
You get a very good overview over the goldsmith's work in Rome in the 19th century, and particularly in the lustrum, where you have all sorts of series of chalices which were either donated by the city of Rome. There was an annual gift. There are the ones donated by the archpriests, by the chapter, and also those given to single popes, like one by the Swiss, German and Austrian youth, given to Pope Pius XI in 1939, which I think is an interesting object to exhibit, especially for this period in history. And there is another one, equally important from a historical point of view, which is the one that the Archbishop of Canterbury gave to the first papal envoy to Britain in 1908, the first papal envoy who visited Britain after the schism of Henry VIII. So there are important objects together with important works of art, for example, like the chalice of the famous goldsmith Castellani, which was a discovery that was made while we were putting up this museum and which colleagues in the British Museum are very interested in.
What is the object that you would say shouldn't be missed? Why should I come to this museum? What really stands out about it?
You should see the wonderful goldsmith reliquary produced for the year 1800 by Valadier.
Now that's the one we see almost as soon as we enter into the museum.
This is the one at the end of the big room, which was put together again, and it's used on the high altar of the Basilica now in its original form again. It was used in 2001 for the first time after many, many years, after a very long period, in its original form. That's a wonderful object. And then there is the spectacular image of the Madonna by Beccafumi, the great Sienese painter of the 16th century, contemporary of Raphael and Michelangelo, a wonderful, wonderful picture. There is the altar panel by Sodoma, and there are really all these vestments, like the vestments of donated by the Borghese, by the family of Paul V, with the cope, and very important vestments, also by Urban VIII. Then one should really see all the relics of St. Pius V, which were arranged, ordered by Pius IX, who had a special relationship to the Basilica and a special veneration for Pius V. Pope Pius IX, at some stage, had decided he wanted to be buried in this basilica, so he donated many objects to the basilica. He had a special veneration for St. Pius V, so he rearranged his relics, and we have his personal vestments and objects also in a kind of reliquary cupboard. Those are only a few of the objects that you really could see when you come.
And a warm thanks there to Professor Arnold Nesselrath of the Vatican Museums, instrumental in the creation of St. Mary Major's exhibits. Have time for today. Thanks for joining me. I'm Tracy McClure. You've been listening to Vatican Radio's English program. Again, thanks for listening. Remember to like our Facebook page. We're also on Twitter, and our webpage is full of interesting stories and feature programs, so do check it out at rv.va. Again, that's rv.va. And why not drop us a line via email? Our address is english@vatiradio.va. Again, that's english@vatiradio.va. We'd love to hear from you. Again, I'm Tracy McClure, thanking you for listening to us here on Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.